Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where does all your money go when you pay your federal income tax bill? Today, of course, is the deadline for individuals to file tax returns for the 2012 calendar year, giving the government about $2.9 trillion toward a $3.67 trillion federal budget. So how will your share of the bill be divided up and spent? Joining us to talk about how the federal budgeting process works is Mattia Kramer. She is senior research analyst for the National Priorities Project. That's a not-for-profit organization that aims to make the federal budget transparent and accessible to Americans. Mattia, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So start, if you would, by giving us just a quick walkthrough of the budgeting and appropriations process.
Sure. Well, there's a few key steps in how our federal government is supposed to craft its budget. And the first one is supposed to be the president's budget request, which starts off the budget process. It's supposed to happen in February. And you might have heard in the news that President Obama just released his budget request last week.
So we're already this year. Yeah.
We're behind schedule this year. So this year is far from the typical year. But it's supposed to be that the president releases his budget in February, and after that, action moves to Congress, House, and Senate. Budget committees are supposed to pass budget resolutions, which are sort of broad blueprints for spending and taxation levels across the whole all areas of government. And after that, action moves to appropriations committees, and that's where sort of the nitty-gritty happens, where lawmakers assign funding levels to every kind of federal program under the sun. And it's intended that all of this budgeting action happens before September 30th, because that's the end of the federal fiscal year. On October 1st, a new fiscal year begins, and it's the intention that we have a new budget in place each year on October 1st, although, especially in recent years, that hasn't happened.
Right. So it remains to be seen if everybody will make up for lost time given the late submission of the federal budget. But we can pass continuing resolutions to buy a little time, as we've done in the past.
Yeah, and actually for this fiscal year, 2013, we're seeing only continuing resolutions. In other words, no actual budget that does the hard work of looking at every federal program, whether spending should go up or down for each of those programs. And instead, we're seeing these sort of temporary spending bills that basically just continue funding levels from the previous year.
Do you think, Mattia, that this is the wave of the future? Is the era of having a budget decided and voted on and ready to go and outlined completely, is that over?
Well, for right now it is, and that's in large part because of politics. The politics have made the budget process an intractable task for Washington. I don't think, though, that it has to be this way. I think that we can demand better from our lawmakers. Lawmakers have talked about moving to a two-year budget cycle so that they would only have to do this process every 2 years when a new Congress begins. I'm not sure that that would solve the problem, though, frankly, because they might just delay their budget work in the same way that they do right now, and actually make no more progress toward an actual budget. So what we really need is to figure out how we can get our lawmakers beyond the kind of politics that make this process impossible right now, and I do believe that's possible.
So it's Congress that actually votes on the amounts of the budget in terms of discretionary spending. Can you talk a little bit about the roles played by the OMB and the Congressional Budget Office and the General Accounting Office?
Sure. OMB, that stands for Office of Management and Budget, that's at the White House, and that basically serves as the president's accounting office. OMB does a huge amount of heavy lifting in the budget process, including compiling budget requests from all of the federal agencies, so whether it's the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Health and Human Services. OMB compiles the budget requests from all of these different agencies and puts it together into the document that forms the president's budget request so that when the president introduces that budget to Congress, there's detailed information about all of those different agencies and what they're doing and their policy priorities and how much money it will take them to carry out their responsibilities. So that's the OMB. The Congressional Budget Office, also known as CBO, is the accounting arm for Congress. And so it does also a huge amount of heavy lifting for the budget process, including crunching all the numbers about the spending implications every time Congress passes legislation or lawmakers introduce bills. CBO puts out important nonpartisan numbers to see what the budgetary implications are of any kind of legislation proposed.
So what is the difference between mandatory and discretionary spending? A lot of people get, I mean, there's still a lot of money being spent on discretionary things, but the vast majority of our spending goes to mandatory budget items.
Yeah, that's right. So the discretionary budget gets all the attention, you might say, in the media, or that's often what we hear about because that's what lawmakers have to enact each year. As its name implies, discretionary spending happens at the discretion of lawmakers. But mandatory spending, which is not as well understood, I think, in the public, takes up about two-thirds of total federal spending. Mandatory spending is money spent on programs in which people by law are entitled to benefits because of certain eligibility rules written into law. So think, for instance, of the Social Security program. When you turn 65, you don't think of Congress as having to approve your Social Security benefits. You'll simply start to receive those benefits because you will have become eligible by virtue of your age. And so Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, these are mandatory programs, and altogether mandatory spending takes up about two-thirds of the federal budget.
So the only way to change what we're spending on those is to change eligibility or to change the amount at which things are compensated.
That's exactly right. So eligibility rules or benefit levels.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about the president's proposal to change the way Social Security cost of living adjustments are calculated and what that might mean for recipients in the future?
Sure. So the president proposed changing the way cost of living adjustments happen in Social Security. So right now, beneficiaries in the Social Security program periodically see cost of living adjustments that are intended to increase their benefits at the pace of inflation. In other words, so that inflation does not erode the value of their Social Security checks. The president has proposed changing the way the government calculates inflation in order to make those cost of living adjustments to something called the chained CPI, and this sounds like a very abstract notion. basically, for regular people, what that means is inflation would rise more slowly from the perspective of the Social Security program, and therefore benefits would rise slower, and beneficiaries would essentially see a benefit cut.
And over time, of course, this benefit cut would magnify, essentially. So decades from now, the impact would be much greater than it might be over the next 5 to 7 years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This change would grow over time and over a number of years would absolutely have a serious impact on beneficiaries.
I mean, what do the experts who are looking at this from a nonpartisan standpoint think about whether people will be able to get by with these lower benefits? I guess the idea behind chain CPI is that in the past, cost of living adjustments have not reflected the fact that rising prices might cause people to change their spending habits.
Yeah, that's right. So and there's absolutely evidence to suggest that chained CPI might be a smarter measure of inflation for the economy as a whole. In other words, it might better model the way that you and I and most people experience inflation. What's at issue, though, here with the Social Security program is whether or not it's the right measure for the particular folks who benefit from Social Security. In other words, largely retirees. And there's not evidence to suggest that chained CPI is better for them, and that's because retirees spend a disproportionate amount of their income on health care and housing. And health care in particular, costs rise faster than the pace of inflation as we currently calculate it, not slower. And so this may well be, in fact, a straight benefit cut and not, in fact, tied to the way that inflation actually happens or retirees experience it.
So we are still borrowing money even as debts mount from past years' borrowing, but a small silver lining is that the rate at which we're borrowing money to cover federal expenses did fall again last year.
Oh, that's right. Since the high in 2009, high in the Great Recession of an enormous budget deficit, deficits have been declining, and that's in large part because of the economy, and it's also because of changes in spending cuts enacted by Congress. So our budget deficit has declined in 2013 and will decline again in 2014 quite sharply.
How much of what we borrow do we borrow from entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare?
Well, that's an interesting question. So a fair amount of the federal debt is actually held by the Social Security program. And this, I think, seems like an abstract or strange concept to most people. The Social Security program has for many years run a surplus in the program. In other words, all the taxes paid in to fund Social Security were larger than the cost of the program. And what Social Security does is use that surplus to buy or invest in Treasury debt. And therefore, a great deal of the federal debt is actually held in the Social Security program. And economists distinguish between our federal debt held by the public, which is what most people think of when they think of the federal debt, and federal debt that's actually held within the government and largely in the Social Security program.
But in terms of overall federal debt, a little more than half is actually owned by foreign investors.
Yeah. Now, when we think about the federal debt and who holds it, absolutely international investors play an important role there. Basically, everybody under the sun around the globe holds U.S. Treasury debt because it's one of the safest places to invest your savings. If you want to invest in a safe place, then U.S. Treasury bonds have historically been one of the safest places to go. When international investors are a major holder of U.S. Treasury debt, about half, about 50%, as you noted, of our federal debt held by the public is in international hands. And, you know, we, of course, think of, I think, China most popularly, but many other Asian countries and countries all around the world, as well as private investors, hold U.S. Treasury debt.
Okay, so how does individual income tax compare as a portion of overall federal tax revenues with what corporate taxes contribute?
Individual income taxes contribute a great deal more. And this is something that has changed over time. So it used to be that corporate income taxes paid a much larger share of federal income tax. So you think back to the middle of the 20th century, we saw a switch from corporate taxes paying more than individual income taxes. Now today, individual income taxes take up about 50%, just shy of total federal tax revenue. Corporate taxes are much less, about 12% in 2013.
So is there reason to believe that because corporations are paying less taxes, perhaps they're hiring more people and more individuals can chip in and it all comes out in the wash in terms of the federal budget at least?
Well, that's a very complicated issue, and I think that economists don't agree exactly how tax rates affect the behavior of corporations or individuals. There's certainly some evidence to suggest that lower tax rates mean that there will be more economic activity. Corporations and individuals will spend more, invest more when there's lower tax rates. But how big of an effect that is unclear. I think that the evidence suggests that the effect is actually rather small.
So the amount in comparison, corporate taxes in comparison to individual income taxes has fallen over the years. But how do U.S. corporate tax rates compare with the rest of the developed world?
Well, this, too, is an area where there's a lot of confusion. So our tax rates, what are called statutory tax rates, which just means the tax rates that are officially on the books, are higher here in the U.S. than in other countries. However, many, many corporations do not pay what are those statutory tax rates, which is about 35% for the largest corporations. Corporations can avoid paying that rate by taking advantage legally of many loopholes and deductions in the tax code, so that what's called our effective tax rate, or what corporations actually pay, is much lower than that 35%, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 22%. And that's actually lower than what corporations in other countries pay.
So one of the things they might do is actually set up shop overseas and funnel some of their profits there.
Yeah, and these overseas tax havens can be used to entirely avoid U.S. income taxes as long as they keep profits overseas. So if they attribute profits to an operation in another country and they never repatriate, it's called, or bring those income dollars, those profit dollars back to the U.S., and they never have to pay U.S. taxes on them, that's created actually quite a problem for many corporations that have many billions of dollars. Apple is an example of this, many billions of dollars held overseas in profits, and essentially it's held captive there from the perspective of Apple because they don't want to bring that money home to pay taxes. There was actually a piece in the New York Times not long ago saying, it was in the New York Times business section, saying, hey, Apple, just bring this money home, pay your taxes, and you'll free up a huge amount of capital that you could use to invest.
Mattia Kramer is with us. She's senior research analyst for the National Priorities Project. That's a group that aims to make the federal budget transparent and accessible to everyday Americans. We are talking about where your taxes go on this Tax Day 2013. You can find Mattia Kramer's website at the National Priorities Project at nationalpriorities.org. We're going to come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It is Tax Day 2013, and in honor of that, we're speaking with Mattia Kramer, who is Senior Research Analyst for the National Priorities Project. You can find them online at nationalpriorities.org. If you've got a question about where your taxes go, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Steve calling from ULIS. Hi, Steve.
Thanks, Chris. Great show.
Thank you.
Talking about chain CPI, which is a fascinating concept as to the future, the chain CPI concept seems to rest on substitution and changes in buying habits in between, say, beef and can't afford beef, so down to chicken, can't afford chicken, so down to, well, cat food. But for the elderly, more of their income is based on housing, energy, and medical care, so you can substitute a primary prescription drug for a generic, but then after that, you're pretty much simply out of luck. So a comment on the comparison with CPI-E versus CPI-chain would be an interesting illumination. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Steve, for that question. I would agree with that assessment that when with the particular bundle of goods that retirees tend to consume, which are heavily healthcare, there are few substitutions that you can make along the lines that chain CPI would suggest. And therefore, the move of that to that new calculation of inflation for Social Security benefits, I think, is not necessarily a smart one from the perspective of income security for the elderly.
How much are we spending out of each tax dollar on healthcare from the federal government?
So when you pay your federal income taxes today, about 20 cents on every dollar will go to health care programs. And that's a share that's been creeping up over the years. Each year it gets a little bit higher, and that's because, and I think as most of us experience in our own lives, health care costs have been rising, not just for the federal government, but for all of us, for our premiums and different kinds of care. And it's absolutely the writing on the wall is that share of our tax dollar going to health care rises, that our lawmakers are need to do something about containing health care costs.
And I guess it stands to reason that federal health care expenditures track pretty closely with the percentage of GDP overall that is taken up by health care in this country.
Yeah, they're both rising. That's certainly the case. Federal health care programs have been able to contain costs a little bit better than the private sector, and that's in large part because when you have one major purchaser of health care, you have a bit more bargaining power to hold down prices, and so we've seen that in different parts of the Medicaid and Medicare programs. I mean, there's also areas where the federal government has not done a good job in bargaining for lower prices, but by and large, federal health care programs have contained costs slightly better than the private sector.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to John in Grand Prairie. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris. Can you guys hear me okay?
We sure can. You're kind of fading in and out, but I think we'll be able to get you. Go ahead.
I'll stand in the right direction. So I have one comment and then one question. And the comment, first off, you made something very, very easy to understand, so I appreciate that, ma'am. But I wanted to just make this observation, and see you can confirm it or deny it, but this whole thing about Social Security surplus and how the fund current year obligations of the federal budget, it reminds me a lot of that scene from Dumb and Dumber when those guys were stealing money out of the briefcase and filling it up with IOUs. If you remember, they went back to the person and said, listen, you're going to get every penny of your dollars back. There's our IOUs from us. And I was just wondering if you thought that was an apt analogy. And then the other point I wanted to make is a question which deals with the CBO, because it was my understanding that the CBO was meant to score stuff and not approve legislation for Congress unless it was deficit neutral. And if that is the case, the CBO has been doing that, how is it possible that we've run up the $16 trillion deficit? Because none of that seems to be deficit neutral because we have gigantic deficits. And I'd like to know your answers to those two questions.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, John, for both those questions. So I do remember that scene in Dumb and Dumber with the suitcase. I don't think that it's quite the right parallel for the Social Security program. Right now, every year, the Federal Treasury pays interest to the Social Security program, and that's money that's used in part to finance Social Security each year. And for all, there's no reason to think that the U.S. Treasury will not continue to pay that interest going forward. So I think that those IOUs are good, though not all IOUs in life, as we know, are good.
Let me jump in for just a second. It's almost like when insurance companies take out secondary investments to make money on the premiums that their members pay in addition to what their members are paying.
Sure, right. And so in that case, that investment income would help to finance the cost of the insurance program. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I think in this case, there's no reason to think that the U.S. Treasury will default on its payments for any reason other than politics, right? So we hear about these debt ceiling scares where the government could default. But in terms of the U.S. Treasury's ability to repay those loans and to pay interest, it continues to be the safest investment out there. And I think Social Security will continue to use that interest income for as far into the future as we could possibly see in order to finance the program.
Okay, and as to John's second question about the CBO not being allowed to sort of approve legislation that is not deficit neutral, what can you tell us about that?
That's not the CBO's role. The CBO is intended to be a number cruncher, so it members of Congress write to see the CBO and say, can you, you know, provide the numbers on this? Can you provide the cost estimates, the scoring of this kind of legislation, or what would the effect of X and Y be on the budget? But the CBO is not in the business of approving legislation, merely to provide those numbers.
What does it take to keep those institutions politically neutral?
Well, it's very difficult. You have to have the right people in those entities, and they have to stay the course on crunching numbers and not providing politically charged testimony. What's made especially difficult is that members, of course, put forth requests that are very politically charged and essentially want CBO to come up with a certain answer. You know, and of course, Democratic and Republican lawmakers are both inclined to do this. And so it's the CBO's job to avoid taking a political stance, but merely to crunch the numbers.
All right. It makes sense that everybody wants justification from this neutral organization to prop up their viewpoint of how we should do this.
That's exactly right. And to the same point, members of Congress write requests to the Congressional Research Service, which is another research organization in Congress, and the Government Accountability Office, which is essentially a watchdog organization within our government. And so members of Congress have a particular motive in writing their requests, and it's the charge of these entities to put back clear, unbiased information.
Why is there transportation funding under mandatory spending?
Well, we have particular funds dedicated to highway spending. You know, we pay particular gasoline taxes, for instance, our trust fund revenue, and then have to be paid out for transportation programs. And so we have certain kinds of mandatory spending that draw on those trust fund revenues from our special gasoline taxes.
So it's essentially guaranteeing that the money goes for what it's supposed to pay for.
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we have Marianne in Dallas. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question that came from the book, The Sham and the Shame of the U.S. Tax System, and it was saying that the 16th Amendment that is in our Constitution wasn't fully ratified by the states, and that it is actually illegal to be getting income tax. And I'm wondering if there is truth in that.
Marianne, thank you for that question. I'm not familiar with that book, but as far as I'm aware, it is absolutely legal and the within the domain of our federal government to create an income tax and collect that money that is in the Constitution, and we feel its effects each year, and especially today on tax day.
But am I right? It's only been about 100 years that most Americans have been paying income taxes.
Oh, that's right. Before that, it was not legal for the federal government to tax income in the way that it does now, and it took that constitutional amendment to make that the case. Prior to that, taxes were mostly in the form of sin taxes. So, of course, right now we still have, in effect, tobacco taxes and other kinds of things that are considered sins and, therefore, from an economics perspective, are smart to tax, because anything that you tax, you get less of. And so taxing income from an economic perspective isn't necessarily the smartest way to go, because it makes us want to work less, because our wage labor is less beneficial.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Back to the phones now. We have John on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for having this wonderful little conversation.
Welcome.
I just called in to give perspective to disability. Some people believe that it's a big wad of candy or something, but I paid in 30 years to live the American dream, and I became disabled, and I get about $980 a month. I'll break that down real quick.
Well, John, I think we've taken your point, and I think it's a good one. A lot of people this year, Mattia, are talking with renewed interest about disability payments. Can you talk about, is that under the Social Security budget?
Yes, Social Security Disability Insurance and SSI, which is a program that's been in the news a lot lately, those are under Social Security and other kinds of income security programs. And, I mean, John, your point is well taken that that disability payment, it is not a huge amount of money. In fact, it's a very small amount of money to live on, and there's a huge amount of scrutiny that comes to that area of the budget in which people think that that money is wasted. And it's a difficult task for policymakers to design disability programs that serve those who need it and doing so in a way that actually truly serves the population with enough money so that they can get by, and then also design a program simultaneously that does not serve those who don't need it. And it's very tricky to come up with the right policy measures to do that. Unfortunately, there's more skepticism about that area of the budget than likely is warranted. Of course, there's some waste and there's some fraud, but it's smaller than people generally believe.
Do you have this in your head offhand, that the sort of upper limit for payroll taxes at this point? Are you taxed up to $120,000 of income?
Sure. For Social Security taxes, we only pay on our first $113,000 of income. And, of course, most Americans have no idea even that
never
Social
get there.
Security. Right. We never get there, certainly. I haven't reached it yet. I look forward to that day. So most Americans have no idea that Social Security taxes phase out on those higher levels of income, and that actually makes the tax regressive. In other words, wealthy people pay a smaller share of their income in Social Security taxes than do middle or lower income folks.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you would like to ask a question about where your tax dollars go on this Tax Day 2013. We have an email here from Dormand, who says, a lot is said about the need for those in Africa to show independence and the ability to support themselves without continuous aid handouts from developed countries. In the U.S., we have a rather absurd infrastructure of agricultural subsidies, Dormand writes, which typically ignore family farms and put enormous sums of money into the pockets of the already wealthy. Can you comment on the charge that if U.S. cotton price support payments were ceased, the income of cotton farmers in Africa would be increased by 10%? I don't know that you can speak to specifically cotton prices, but maybe you can talk a little bit about agricultural subsidies.
Well, there's definitely disagreement over whether our aid programs are designed in an efficient way right now. There's many who believe that to be most effective, our aid program should not purchase agricultural products from the U.S. and ship them overseas as we do right now, and that's essentially a giveaway to agricultural companies and shipping companies, but rather that we should buy products that are domestic to the companies that we're serving. In other words, give the business to the producers there. So there's certainly disagreement about how that should be constructed and whether we should prioritize our own industry or not in order to maximize the impact on those who most need it.
So unemployment and labor amounts to 12.2 cents of every tax dollar. Can we expect that percentage to continue to fall as the jobless rate declines?
Yeah, for two reasons, actually. So that 12.2 cents out of each income tax dollar this year to unemployment and other labor programs actually also includes part of Social Security in 2012. That's the year we're paying taxes on right now, because if you remember, there was a payroll tax holiday in effect last year, and so we actually saw our Social Security tax rate go down. Because of that, Social Security did not bring in enough in a single year to cover the cost of its program. And so some of our federal income taxes went to Social Security in 2012, which is generally not the case. And so that unemployment and labor figure will go down both because we will no longer use our income taxes to fund Social Security this year and moving forward because that payroll tax holiday expired, and then also because there are fewer Americans who are unemployed and drawing unemployment benefits.
So that extra money in people's pockets every 2 weeks or every month may have been helpful to individual families, but there's essentially what you're telling us is there was no free lunch when it came to the payroll tax holiday.
That's right. So it did have an impact on the economy in a positive way because people had more money in their pockets. But that money came out of Social Security, and it was never clear whether that was a wise policy choice to borrow from Social Security or take from Social Security as a measure of boosting the economy in the near term. There were a lot of people who said Social Security is absolutely the wrong place to use for stimulus money.
So once again, the largest allocation of each discretionary dollar goes to fund military expenses. It's 26.5 cents for this year. Is that amount also going to fall as we decrease troop presence overseas?
Yeah, we probably will see that share going to the military decline, although in small amounts. The money that goes to troops overseas for war funding is actually a small share of total funding for the military. Most of that money is the Department of Defense base budget, which is still in the many hundreds of billions of dollars this year and is will be next year too, even as we hear about cuts to the defense budget. So any cuts that take place are likely to be very, very small. So we will see probably that share of our federal income taxes going to the military decline, but only by a small amount, if at all.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Levi on the line in Farmers Branch. Hi, Levi.
Hi, Chris. I would like to know if the groups, the offices that make projections, like the Congressional Budget Office, ever go back and look at the projections they made to see how accurate they were once, you know, they put a tax increase in place and then see if, you know, the what they estimated would happen did happen.
Good question.
Oh, sure, they definitely do. They go back and say, you know, our projections of economic growth were maybe too optimistic or too pessimistic, and therefore the projections that we made about revenue or budget deficits changed. What they also do is they provide a range of estimates. So they say, you know, high-end, low-end estimates of how much the economy will grow and therefore how much tax revenue will bring in. And then what they do is choose the middle range of the high and low estimates. And so they feel in that way that they provide to lawmakers the most likely scenario, but they also provide that range and the supporting information about it.
We're talking about where your taxes go on this Tax Day 2013 with Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst for the National Priorities Project. You can find their work online at nationalpriorities.org. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mattia Kramer of the National Priorities Project, where she works as a senior research analyst. We're talking about where your tax dollars go on this April 15th, 2013. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Jonathan on the line in Denton. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Sorry, I'm a little nervous. First time on the radio.
It's okay, welcome.
Okay, my question is two-part. One's a comment, and then the second part comes question. I was in constitutional law class the other day. The side subject of churches being tax-exempt came up in discussion. And we didn't really get in-depth into it because our teacher wanted to avoid such a taboo subject inside the university. And I was just wondering if churches were, in fact, tax-exempt, like it was taken away, what effect would that have on the economy, like immediate/long-term?
You mean if churches were suddenly not tax-exempt?
Exactly. Okay. They would actually have to pay their tax.
Have you looked into this, Mattia?
I have not looked into this. It's certainly the case that churches and many other kinds of nonprofit organizations do not right now pay income taxes. One effect would be, of course, that the federal government would raise a lot more revenue from, you know, many well-off entities. For instance, Harvard University is a very wealthy entity, and it's tax-exempt because it's a nonprofit What the effect on the economy would be, hard to say. Probably not huge, although we think about the value created by the nonprofit sector doing social services and other kinds of things that the private sector doesn't provide and government doesn't provide. We would likely lose in those areas because money would be going toward taxes as opposed to services. But in terms of the economic impact, I can't speak to that.
Yeah, there's interesting questions now as well about whether the tax break given to people for donating to nonprofits ought to be reduced.
Yeah, there is talk about that in large part because tax deductions have become a major budget issue. Mm-hmm. They're very expensive from the perspective of the federal government. A huge amount of tax revenue is lost to deductions and credits and loopholes in the tax code. And in fact, in 2012, if we had had no deductions or credits in our tax code, no loopholes or exclusions of any kind, we would have not had a budget deficit. That gives you a sense of how large all of those deductions and credits are. So the charitable income deduction, the charitable donation deduction, is under scrutiny right now, whether it should be kept in place. And some of the scrutiny, as you've alluded to, is because many wealthy individuals take advantage of it in ways that not intended. For instance, some very wealthy people set up their own charities and then donate money to their own charities, still have access to using that money as they see fit through charitable purposes, but don't pay taxes on it.
Mattia, what can you tell us about the budget effects of the sequestration?
Well, the sequestration refers to automatic across-the-board spending cuts, which were scheduled to take effect at the start of this year and were delayed for a couple months, ultimately took effect on March 1st. It's about an $85 billion cut, mostly to discretionary programs. So that's the military and then non-mandatory. So remember, we talked about this mandatory discretionary distinction. Discretionary programs ranging from, you know, education to environment, these sorts of things. So a whole range of tiny discretionary programs see budget cuts this year because of sequestration. Now, the ultimate impact is not really known yet. We haven't seen exactly how the cuts will fall. Agencies are still sort of scrambling to implement the cuts, and many are putting into place furloughs and so forth. Basically, the jury's still out on what the impact will be.
Of course, $85 billion is a huge amount of money. That's the amount you said, right? $85
billion? $85
billion. Okay. But in a $3.67 trillion overall federal budget, it doesn't seem quite so large.
That's true as a percentage measure. However, that $85 billion does not apply mostly to mandatory programs. And we were just talking about how most of the budget goes to mandatory programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Some of the sequester applies to Medicare. Most of it, though, applies only to the discretionary budget, which is just around a third of total federal spending. And therefore, its impact is a bit larger in those programs that actually are seeing cuts.
The federal budget represents nearly a quarter of the total U.S. GDP. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's around 22%.
Okay. Would significant cuts to the federal budget shrink overall GDP in this country?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's just because of the way we calculate GDP. So GDP, which is a measure of the size of the U.S. economy, adds together government spending and investment spending and consumer spending and the difference between our exports and imports. And so that's how we add up the size of the U.S. economy. So since one of the pieces is government, if we cut government spending, it would necessarily reduce GDP. Now, some people argue that ultimately would be better for the economy because the government would not crowd out private investment and spending. When the economy is weak, though, right now, and the private sector is anemic in terms of its investment and spending anyhow, cutting the public sector is generally considered to be not a wise move because the private sector, we know, at least right now, while things are still not great in terms of our economy, the private sector won't step in and fill the void.
We have an email here from Donald in Carrollton who says, if our effective tax rate for corporations is 22% after deductions, what is the effective tax rate for individuals? Donald says, I'd also like to know if we simplified the tax system to a flat tax, would rates be lower for both individuals and corporations?
You know, I don't know offhand the exact effective effective individual income tax rate. It's also in the 20s. It's between 20 and 25%. So it's right there in the same range, although I can't pin down the exact number.
But that's an average, I should jump in and say.
Exactly. That's just an average tax rate. So if you take all federal income tax returns, the average tax rate paid is somewhere in the low 20s, comparable to the corporate income tax rate.
And is it possible to say that a flat tax would or would not reduce the amount that individuals and corporations are paying?
The flat tax, it would be different for depending on who you are. Mm-hmm. Generally, though, a flat tax would be regressive in the sense that relative to our current tax code. Right now, we have a tax code that's designed to be progressive so that tax rates rise on higher income. And if we went with a flat tax, that would definitely mean a substantial tax cut for the wealthiest individuals, because think right now, you know, on top dollar income, your tax rate approaches 40%, and certainly no one proposes a tax rate, a flat tax of that kind of level. So the wealthiest individuals would see a cut to whatever that flat tax rate would be, whether it be 10% or 15%, you know, whatever magic number folks propose as a flat tax. So that would be a regressive move.
So we spend about 3.5 cents of every tax dollar on education. How does that compare with other parts of the world as we look in this country, take a more critical eye at the way we are educating our young people?
Yeah, that 3.5 cents to education is often considered to be the most unpopular part of the sort of tax receipt. When, as a National Priorities Project, a lot of what we do is educate people about where their tax dollars go. Folks are astonished often to see how little of their tax dollars go to education. An opinion poll suggests that Americans would like to see much more money go to education than is currently spent. I think that some of our peers in Western Europe and so forth spend more on education, although the precise comparison depends on the country.
Is the problem that we want more spent on education, but we can't decide where to cut out spending elsewhere to make that possible?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the politics, that, you know, everybody likes the sound of spending more on education, but because of the political powers that be, lawmakers aren't swayed in that direction. So there's much more powerful interests pulling our tax dollars in other directions, and then clear and present needs like healthcare costs, which are constantly rising and crowding out other kinds of expenditures. So figuring out how to allocate that money to education in light of the political difficulties is essentially the issue.
It might surprise people to know we actually spend more on housing and community, which either you probably are aware that you're receiving such services, or you are not very connected to them at all. But that money doesn't just pay for low-income housing, but it pays for community development. Is that right?
Oh, yes. The Community Development Block Grant is a major program that allows cities and towns across the country to access funding to engage in community revitalization projects. You know, there's also, we don't think about it, but there's many kinds of projects that, we have clean air, clean water, those kinds of things, all sorts of community development projects that, you know, we don't think twice about, but that we enjoy the benefits of every day.
So you have a particular gift, Mattia, for making all of this very understandable to average people like me. And the website is fantastic at National Priorities Project. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the sort of raw data that comes in and the process of putting this into a digestible form for people who are not economists.
Well, the goal from the perspective of a research analyst like myself is that once a year we get raw data from the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, at the White House, and they put all of that data into a huge Excel spreadsheet, and it's our job to make sense of it, to adjust it for inflation, to sort it into little tiny categories that make sense to people, you know, whether it's healthcare or education. When we get this information from the government, it's not, of course, sorted into these easy-to-understand categories, and that's our job to take the raw information and to put it into something that has meaning for people, where folks can say, okay, now I get it, and then take the next step, which is to see how what our government is doing matches up with our own priorities. You know, and so again, that education example is a popular one. Folks look at that and say 3.5 cents on the dollar to education is not enough, and that gives people a weigh-in to what Washington is doing and how it compares to their values.
Is it always clear where everything should go, which bucket it should drop into? I'm thinking things like science and energy and environment. Is it always obvious that something needs to be in the science column as opposed to the energy and environment column?
Well, in that particular case, it is in part because science is actually such a terribly small share of the budget. There's actually only a couple buckets. It's basically basic scientific research and NASA that fall into that science category. There are some things, though, that don't have a proper place, and government is often our catch-all category. So this year, about 5.4 cents on each income tax dollar goes to government. That includes not just the having and functioning of a government in Washington, but it also our justice system and federal corrections and the maintaining the rule of law in this country. So government can be a catch-all when there's commerce and sort of these last little categories that we have to put into one of these buckets.
What do you think is the, are there particular things that people tend to be misinformed about with regard to the way that our taxes are being spent or our money is being allocated?
Yeah, the most common one is foreign aid. People think that a huge amount of the federal budget goes to foreign aid. It's well under 1% of our tax dollars or federal spending goes to foreign aid. And people have the sense that if we only stopped spending so much money on foreign aid, it would solve our budget problems. We could close our budget deficits. In fact, foreign aid is a rounding error in the scheme of the federal budget, and eliminating it would do almost nothing to affect deficits, and it probably wouldn't do great things for our international standing either.
Is that a fraction of the 1.4 cents on the dollar we spend for international affairs?
That's right. So foreign aid is just part of that 1.4 cents because that includes the State Department budget and some other things.
Mm-hmm. Once people look at all this, they understand how the money is being spent, and they have a problem with something. They have an issue. They disagree. What are the best ways that regular people can take action to see about getting some of these things adjusted?
Yeah, the most important one is being in touch with your elected officials. I think a lot of people have the idea that they can't have an effect by calling or writing to their elected officials. That's not the case. In Washington, our members of Congress, our senators, their legislative aides are keeping track of constituent sentiment on particular issues. They are listening, but very, very few of us actually get in touch with our elected officials to communicate our priorities for federal spending. We can have an impact, and imagine a world in which many more Americans, all of us, were in touch with our elected officials on a regular basis to say, I'm in favor of this, I'm not in favor of this, please spend more on education, whatever is your own priority. I think we would live in a different world.
Does a paper letter carry more weight these days than an email?
Yes, it does. I think that there's still a sense that that paper communication means something. But, you know, it all makes a difference. Emails make a difference. Social media, you know, Facebook and Twitter have the advantage of what you do is seen in the public eye, so other constituents can see that you were in touch with your legislator and, you know, you were in favor of this particular thing. You know, they say, oh, you know, actually I believe in that too, and I'm going to get in touch too. It puts a certain pressure on the legislators because it occurs in the public eye in a way that emails and written letters do not.
The last thing I want to ask you about is, historically speaking, how big of an issue is it to raise the debt ceiling? How many times have we done this in the past century?
Oh, dozens. In previous years, this has not been a big deal. The debt ceiling, of course, is the statutory limit, the legal limit on the amount of debt that Congress allows itself to hold. So it's sort of an arbitrary level. Congress says, no, we will not carry any more debt beyond $16 trillion or whatever the number is. In previous years, Congress has raised that limit without any fuss, without any fanfare. It's become a very political event since 2010, and some lawmakers have said, no, we must not raise the debt ceiling any further. But what that's basically like is going to a fancy restaurant, ordering all the delicious food you want, and then skipping out on the check. So the moment to reduce borrowing is when you're ordering that fancy meal, not when the bill comes.
Mattia Kramer is Senior Research Analyst for the National Priorities Project. You can find more information online at nationalpriorities.org. Mattia, always a pleasure and so informative. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.